That's the rich, ethereal sound of Emerson, Lake & Palmer from 1973, Still You Turn Me On, Greg Lake on lead vocals. We're talking with Dr. Bruce Maccabee, whose new book, The FBI-CIA UFO Connection, sort of lays it out. I mean, if you ever had a question of whether we've been lied to or not, this pretty much puts it into proper perspective, because the answer is a resounding yes. And it really is no other way to look at it. Dr. Maccabee paints a very distinct picture of just where we've been lied to and how often. And, of course, the masters of prevarication in our government might be CIA. For all the good that they have done over the years, they've done some pretty sneaky stuff. There's one particular episode that we're going to talk about in the next segment. Some documents that surfaced, their origin was the Canadian government. A scientist who worked up there had been in communication with his counterparts in the U.S., who told him that the UFO secret was classified higher than the H-bomb, and it was very, very real. We'll get into that and more in our final hour with Dr. Bruce Maccabee here on Coast to Coast AM. Bruce, we're never going to have time to cover all of the lies about UFOs told by CIA and Air Force and other entities within the government, but there's two things I want to focus on regarding CIA, and it deals with the one is the one I just referred to in the tease there about Wilbert Smith and Sarbacher. I have a personal connection to Sarbacher that I'll tell you about sometime in person, but I wonder if you can share with us the significance of that exchange and the information that surfaced years after those two got together.
Well, I had nothing to do with the CIA, actually, but that was a document generated in 1950 by Wilbert Smith, who was a high-level electronic technician in Canada, and he had read Scully's book and Major Donald Kehoe's books, two books on that claimed the flying saucers were real and extraterrestrial. And he tried to make a check through the Canadian embassy with somebody in the United States who could give him some information. And it turned out that he ended up talking to a man by the name of Sarbacher. I talked to Sarbacher myself.
Oh.
And Sarbacher, well, Stan Friedman was the guy who located him, more or less. And then Stan gave me the guy's phone number. I called him up. And he had written a document back in 1950 saying that flying saucers were the highest level security, even higher than the H-bomb, and they existed, and there was a group trying to figure out how they operated and so on. This is an important document because it comes from the outside world, you might say. It's not part of the FBI, not part of the CIA, not part of the American Air Force, and yet it acted like a window on what the Air Force was doing. Sarbacher said that he knew some people who worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Air Technical Intelligence Center, and they had given him some information about these creatures that were in flying saucers, he gathered from the way they were described that they were sort of constructed like insects. Now, this is just one of a number of reasons for thinking that something big was going on down under way under the table.
Describe who Sarbacher was, though. I mean, why he would have been in a position to know. He was scientific advisor at the presidential level, wasn't he?
He was an expert in missile control theory and stuff like that, and had been working for the government during the Second World War, but then he retired from government work, and he became what's called a dollar-a-year man. That is to say, he wasn't really paid anything for what he did, but he was allowed to keep his clearances, and he could interact with the people at the clearance level that he had. That's how he happened to know about this stuff that was going on at Wright Field.
It sounds like he was invited to participate in the conferences or panel meetings of something that sounds a whole heck of a lot like MJ-12, even if it wasn't called that.
Yeah, he said that he had been invited to go to a conference at Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, but hadn't been able to make it. What he learned, he was told, I suppose, over the phone or whatever.
So you got guys like him saying it's real, it's classified really high, at CIA, all these other agencies getting different reports that they try to deny that
let
they
me
have.
tell you about the CIA, because
Okay.
what comes out in the book is a little bit different from what people have been thinking.
All right.
The CIA paid very little attention to the subject in the first years. There was a couple of review memoranda generated in 1949 by a guy who was definitely not impressed by what he was studying. It wasn't until the summer of 1952, which I call the year of the UFO, when the Air Force collected 1,500 and some reports of objects, or 2,000 reports, I should say, of 1,500 objects. But anyway, just after this press conference that we talked about in an earlier section this evening, where General Sanford said that it was all natural phenomena and so on, there had been so many sightings it was apparently too much for the CIA to just sit back and look. So the director of the CIA said to some deputy directors to review the situation and let them know what was going on. And so they did. And they got their information by going to Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, Wright Patterson Air Force Base. And guess what? The Air Force lied to them. Now that's the unique wrinkle in the book that nobody's ever thought of before. The Air Force did not tell the CIA about the 2 or 3% that couldn't be explained. The Air Force was adamant, according to the document in the FBI file and the CIA file, where a man is writing what we were told by the Air Force. He said the Air Force adamantly rejected the idea that there were flying saucers or spacecraft flying around. Everything, the Air Force said that everything can be explained as misidentifications, hoaxes, and delusions, misidentifications of natural and man-made phenomena. And they also said that the Air Force also rejected the top secret project, American project explanation, and rejected the idea that the Soviets would be sending their special craft over the United States. The CIA itself made a check on the special projects of the United States explanation, and one guy pointed out that it's true that they couldn't locate any special project, but even further evidence is the Air Force would never order their aircraft to shoot down their own special projects.
Right. Right.
So anyway,
so,
the
Air Force
point,
lies
the point,
to
I'm, see. Point I'm making is that since the Air Force was adamant that everything could be explained one way or another, that shows up in the CIA file. And it wasn't until the top scientist, Marshall Chadwell, studied some reports in the fall that he began to reverse the opinion, I guess you might say, that there, and decided there really was something going on. When he decided that there was something really going on, he tried to get interest on the part of the advisory council for the president, and they decided they weren't sure they wanted to set up a special project to study flying saucers independently of the Air Force, but they decided what they would do is they have a panel meeting of experts. And decide to go. They would go with the recommendations of the panel, and that turned out to be the famous Robertson panel of January 1953, where a few guys who knew nothing about the subject studied it for a few
for
hours.
For one day, yeah, right.
Three days maximum for any one person, and they came to a conclusion that everything could be explained, and that the reports themselves, however, were dangerous because spurious flying saucer reports could clog information channels if there happened to be an attack from the Soviet Union, if the Soviets were to generate flying saucer reports in large numbers, and our defensive aircraft could be flying off chasing nothing, when they should be chasing the Soviet bombers. So the CIA concluded that there wasn't any threat from flying saucers because they probably didn't exist, but there could be a threat from the reports. And so they decided that as many sightings as possible should be explained, and the explanations given to the American people, so that people would be less likely to report things in the sky. That's become the policy of so-called debunking of cases.
Well, there it is in one document, the policy of debunking, the idea of making fun of or ridiculing witnesses and stripping it of its aura of mystery, right? That was one of the phrases.
That's right.
You know, that's there. I don't think that you can express it in a more succinct way of the origin of a cover up, or at least a continuation of a cover up. And there's another way to demonstrate it. It's of a more recent vintage, and it's something that you really did some really magnificent work on. It's about the CIA and spy planes and Area 51. As you know, I've done a lot of work on Area 51 and reports out of there that some find credible and some not. You dug into this blanket explanation from CIA. Oh yeah, all those UFO reports from the 50s and 60s, that was us. It was the U-2, it was the SR-71. And so many news organizations bought that. And you have pretty much conclusively proven that it's a bunch of baloney.
Well, the U-2 explanation keeps popping up. It first came about in 1998, I guess, when or 1997, when the CIA history written by Gerald Haynes was published in Studies in Intelligence in the unclassified version. And it's been recycled several times since when somebody would read the what Haynes wrote in his history. I copied it right into my book, so there wouldn't be any question as to what Haynes had written. And basically he had said that he had been told by the guys, now he was doing historical research in the mid-1990s, and he said he had been told by some of the guys who had been involved in the U-2 project back in the 50s that more than 50% of the sightings recorded after the U-2 started flying were sightings of the U-2. And as readers of the book will know, but we haven't really talked about yet.
No.
I had a window on the Air Force that few people had because I went there numerous times. I even lectured on UFOs a couple of times at the headquarters, the Air Force headquarters. So this historian, Gerald Haynes, had written this history, and he asked me to review it for accuracy with respect to the Air Force, not necessarily with respect to the CIA documents that he used in his history. And I saw that part about the U-2, and I told him he was going to run into a gauntlet of fire from ufologists for this explanation. But when I analyzed it, the analysis in the book is about as succinct as you can get. You know that the U-2 started flying in August of 1955. So you add up the number of sightings in 10 months before 1955, and you add up the number of sightings in, from 1955 on for 10 more months, and compare the 10 months before and the 10 months after. If there had been a huge increase in sighting reports due to the U-2, it would show up. Oddly enough, I think the number is 410 sightings before in 10 months and 410 sightings after in 10 months. No bump at all. If you look at the month-by-month sighting list, month-by-month, it did bump up a couple of sightings in August from what it was in July, but then it dropped down again in September, so they didn't stop flying the U-2. Bottom line is, when you look at the sighting statistics, there's nothing that you can attribute to the U-2.
Well, that's the most amazing part of it, is they give out this blanket, unsupported, unsubstantiated explanation. They don't even use examples. Remember this ex-UFO case? That was us, and here's why. They just They throw it out, assume the media will run with it, and they were right. I mean, it's preposterous on its face. The U-2 doesn't look like a flying saucer. It doesn't fly like one. It doesn't hover. It's ridiculous.
That's right.
There's so many today, we're not going to be able to cover all this stuff, but there's so many today UFO documents of questionable provenance. A lot of the stuff, somebody people would say MJ-12 documents are questionable. A lot of stuff about MJ-12, about crashed flying saucers, they show up in people's mailbox, they look real, they use typeface, they're dated from that era, they use real names and real events. But there's no way to verify them. They weren't acquired through the Freedom of Information Act. What do you make of that? Is that somebody trying to muddy the waters, either a civilian who wants to cash in or get attention, or is it an intelligence operation?
Well, let me emphasize that everything that I put into the book that has to do with arguments with respect to cover-up and so on is based on documents that anybody can get a hold of and are unquestionably real.
Right.
As you pointed out, the MJ-12 documents and a number of others are, shall we say, they may be real, but they got a lot of questions. So my guess is if Roswell is not the real thing, then somebody's been dumping a lot of trash onto the field for some reason or other. It's even more provocative if Roswell is a real thing. This trash dump of documents didn't start until after the Roswell incident book was published. And if you wanted to discredit something really badly, one way to do it is to introduce a lot of garbage into the field. And my guess is that if Roswell is not real, or if Roswell were real, then all this stuff that we're seeing is an attempt to bury Roswell in a bunch of question marks. Make it seem less real, shall we say.
Well, to make it less real and to cloud the water, to muddy the waters, to make it so hard. I mean, even a UFO devotee like me, sometimes you want to just give up on it. It's so cloudy and murky, and so many phony witnesses come forward, so many false leads and false ends. It's pretty hard to sort it out.
Yep, that's why I like my book.
Yeah, well, that's why I like your book, too. You must get attacks, though. The fact that you work for the Navy all these years and are able to pursue UFOs, people got to say, well, this guy's part of it. Whatever he puts out, he must be part of the grand scheme of things. He's working with the bad guys.
Yeah, well, I'm not working with the bad guys. And as I said way back at the very beginning of this conversation, the most pressure that I got from above was to leave us out of it. That is to say, interviews and so on, don't tell where you worked. Now, that was years ago, so I can say where I work now for the Navy. But very often in the old days, back in the 80s and 90s, I would say I worked for the Navy, but not mention what laboratory. Now, of course, I can mention what laboratory I was at.
You know, there are a lot of folks who think the Navy is where the heart of the mystery leads, that if anyone is maintaining the cover-up, it's the Navy, not the Air Force. You ever seen anything in documents? Have you ever filed FOIAs on the Navy? Ever seen anything that support? Yeah?
Again, in the FBI file, there was a document from February of 1950, I think it was, a very interesting sighting report, multiple sightings up in Alaska by Navy flyers who are on patrol to detect and drive off Soviet fighters. Anyway, these Navy people flying around had sightings of lights. Typical air like the Air Force having dogfights with lights. But this was the Navy doing it up in Alaska.
I'll tell you what, Bruce, we're going to have to finish that on the other side of the break. Frank Sinatra is flying us to the moon, and we need to take a short break. We'll be right back, and we'll open up the phone lines with your questions from my guest, Dr. Bruce McAbee, right after this. Across the Universe, John Lennon considered the lyrics to that song to be among the best that he ever wrote. That was from Let It Be, 1969. We're entering our final segment with my guest, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, one of the pioneers of UFO research and a guy who was personally responsible for helping to squeeze so many hundreds of documents out of the CIA and FBI. In the future, if you're a serious student of this topic and you get into an argument with somebody in your family or a colleague or coworker who says, there's nothing to it, there's no proof, here's your answer to them, is the proof is in these documents. This paper trail establishes beyond any doubt that this phenomena is real. Our government recognized it was real, investigated it, researched it, wrote reports about it, and then covered it all up and lied to us about it. And I think that's those are some of the indisputable conclusions you can reach after you read this book. So I hope you'll check it out. When we come back, we'll take some questions from you, let Bruce continue his story about the UFO incident in Alaska, and then wrap it up. Thanks. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast. Before the break, Bruce, I was asking you about what the U.S. Navy might know, and you had a story about an incident in Alaska. Please continue.
Well, part of the reason I brought that up is the document that I found on that incident was in the FBI file. When I, finding that document being a Navy document, I wrote under the Freedom of Information Act of the Navy, and they basically claimed they had nothing.
I mean, is part of that that, they purged the files, or do you think they've purged the files on purpose to get rid of stuff about UFOs?
I don't know. But they didn't cough up anything other than several sheets of analysis of a couple of UFO movies that are already available in the FBI in the Air Force file.
I asked you about whether you get accused of being part of the cover-up yourself. More pointedly, you know, your name has come up in association with something called the Aviary, and I think people get a conspiratorial bent about this thing and think anybody who's associated with something as sneaky as that, something mysterious like that, must be part of the cover-up. There are people like yourself who work for the government, even intelligence agencies, who are interested in getting to the bottom of this mystery, right?
Yes, that's true. First, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Richard Dolan for publishing the book and Jeff Rissman for his beautiful cover.
Sure.
As far as me being part of the cover-up is concerned, if you read through my sizable collection of analyses and so on of various cases, when I find something that I can't explain, I'm right up front of talking about it. I have not covered up any cases that are incorrectly explained, any of them. I do explain a lot of cases, but I offer what I expect to be correct explanations. Like, for example, in the Mexican Air Force case that you every now and then see recycled in TV, the surveillance plane flying over the Yucatan Peninsula that detected.
Yes, yes, I've reported that one too. Yeah.
Yeah, and on the first half of that sighting, first half of that event involved just a radar sighting. They picked out, they were chasing something that their radar detected, but they couldn't see it visually, and they couldn't see it in their infrared viewers. There was something there that was invisible, but it reflected radar. And after they had to make a sharp right-hand turn to stop chasing this object to go back and get more fuel, the object increased its speed and flew away, shall we say. Now, that part of the sighting is definitely a UFO. The rest of the sighting, which is what the press concentrates on because it's visual, it may well have been flares from oil field 100-some miles away. The point I'm making is I call one half of it right up front a UFO, the radar UFO, the other half possibly explained. I'm not covering up anything on either one.
You know, you, in addition to your work in ferreting out all these documents over the years, you're sort of a go-to guy when it comes to UFO photo and video analysis. I want to ask you briefly, I mean, with the advent of all kinds of computer technology at everyone's fingertips, You see a UFO video that is more fantastic than anything Hollywood produce online almost every day. People crank this stuff out. It's almost to the point where video and photos don't mean anything anymore because the CGI and things of that sort are so good.
Yep, and you have to rely upon the background story. And when you find something on the internet that looks really good, but you haven't a clue as to who made it, or if it's published by Anonymous or something like that, you have to take it with a grain of salt. The cases that I've worked on have often been proven or disproven by what are called the circumstantial evidence surrounding the taking of photos or video. If there's no witness to talk about, no way to analyze whether the thing, what is shown is consistent with the background or whatever, all you can do is just say, well, maybe not. Why waste my time? We would need an army of photo analysts to correctly interpret every one of the videos that's on the internet right now. And really only a couple of people like D'Antonio who are good enough to be able to deconstruct the CGI aspect.
Yeah, these people should be ashamed of themselves for wasting everyone's time and muddying the waters on what could be a really important phenomena for all of us. One other question I want to ask before I go to the phones, and that's about disclosure. We've got a lot of people who think, oh yeah, any day now it's going to happen. The government's going to admit, the government in quotation marks, is going to admit what it knows. President's going to make a speech, and here it comes. Give me your general take on those waiting for disclosure.
I have long said that disclosure will come when more than half of the population absolutely knows it's real. And then it's the emperor has no clothes syndrome. Somebody will stand up and say, look, they're real. And everybody will say, yes, they're real. And the government will say, oh, we've known it all along. But before we get to the phone callers, I'd like to say something about the way the book is put together in the third
Sure,
section. The
sure.
first section of the book has to do largely with the interplay between the FBI and the Air Force. And this is where you get the impression that something was covered up way back at the very beginning. The second section of the book is what might call the old CIA section, and the documents that were released. The documents were released under the Freedom of Information Act. They were released in December of 1978. And that's the section where I said the Air Force lied to the CIA. And the third section of the book is my own direct experience. I had a unique opportunity to learn about the FBI sort of from the inside. Not that I was an FBI employee, but I went there a number of times as a result of my Navy work that the CIA was interested in. And so we discussed projects having to do with laser-generated underwater sound. You can read all about it in the book. But that gave me opportunities to see whether the CIA people really knew any more about the subject than I did, and I concluded that I never ran anybody who knew more about it than I did. You can read how I was asked to write a briefing for the president's science advisor in 1993. That was John Gibbons. And my CIA contact said that Gibbons needed to know something about flying saucers, so could I write something? And I did. And you'll find the background story behind the Japan Airlines 1628 investigation that I did. A number of other things in this latter section, including, oddly enough, a ghost story by Christian Bernard, the surgeon who did the first heart transplant.
Well, it's good stuff, and it's more than we could talk about in 3 hours, that's for sure.
You remember reading that? You remember reading about
Yeah, we don't have enough time to get into that, but yeah, it's Jeff in Culver City on the wild card line. Jeff, that's a familiar voice and a familiar name. What's on your mind?
Yeah, how you doing, George and Mr. McAbee? Yeah, I can't understand the reason for this continued secrecy. The investigators' reasoning is that mass chaos would erupt and that the religious establishment would be turned upside down. Well, the public wants to know of other life forms, and for centuries, religions have always incorporated new information and twisted it around for their own beliefs and practices. But my question is this, Mr. McAbee. The witnesses who were interviewed by the FBI, were they questioned in depth about these UFOs, various shapes, sizes, functions, and capabilities? And was any of this information shared with aircraft manufacturers like Boeing, Lockheed, and so forth, And would all that explain all these technological aviation advances we have now? And I'll take your answer off there.
Well, first of all, let me say the FBI did not do a very good investigating job when they interviewed witnesses. They would get a general idea. Remember, they were looking for communist subversion, so they would listen to the story by the witness, and if it seemed to be a little bit phony, they would say so. Otherwise, they would just record what the witnesses said. They did not get all the details of the sightings. Sometimes the Air Force would then investigate witnesses and interview them and get more details out. See, what was the second part of the question was what?
I'm sorry, Jeff is gone. So we're going to go to Randy in Las Vegas.
Was this information given to airplane manufacturers?
Yes.
I would say probably not.
Okay. Randy in Las Vegas on the west of the Rockies line. How you doing? You're on with Dr. Bruce McAbee.
I'm great. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a burning question. I've lived in Vegas, you know, for like 30 years, and twice I've seen burnt orange orbs, you know, floating across the sky. And my main question, I guess, is, you know, if these guys are so far advanced, why do they keep bumping into our planet and crashing?
Yeah, fair enough question. You know, we see some of these conferences, Bruce, where they study UFO crashes, and if you believe all of them, there's been dozens.
I sort of take that with a grain of salt. I mean, it may be true, but the problem is you can't prove anything. You know, the best one that I'm aware of would be the Roswell situation, which has gone through years now of investigation. And the best that the skeptics can come up with is it's a mogul balloon. And they're confronted by the fact that mogul balloons are just like weather balloons, but with much more material. How come nobody could identify it?
You do get reports of burnt orange orb type things through over the years, over the decades. I've even heard of some of them myself. I mean, that's not that unusual. It seems like the UFO technology morphs over the years, but it stays just a little bit ahead of what we presumably have. You ever thought
well,
that?
There are orbs. If you read in the book, at Killeen Base, where they stored Fort Hood, where they stored atomic bombs back in the 40s, and they, at the time of the green fireball stuff,
yeah,
they were having orbs flying around, what we would now call orbs. They call lights that traveled around at high or low speeds and sort of meandered around, and they'd appear for a period of time and then go off. And they had what you might call prototype orb sightings way back in the late 40s. I don't know what they represent. But they had some good data on them. There's no doubt that something was happening. We just don't know what it was.
Nick in Michigan on the wild card line. Hi, Nick. You're on with Dr. Bruce McAbee. Hello?
Hey there. Yes, hey. Good to be with you. Pursuant to your comment, George, about Ben Rich, I remember a guest, well, actually a daughter of a retired and now deceased NASA scientist who authored a book, Unconventional Flying Objects. And then I remember John Lear's adamant declaration that there has always been a deep cover secret space program. And then I recalled the Philadelphia experiment and the disappearance of Flight 29. The Navy Avengers, 5 December 1945. I think it was five or nine Avengers that just disappeared in the thin air out of Fort Lauderdale over the Bermuda Triangle. So I tend to think that there's some really advanced, ultra sophisticated, super high tech instruments that not only cloak but disappear ships and planes, and I think it's now advanced, as John Lear insists, to the point where, for instance, these large triangular so-called UFOs, plasma pulse technology,
Hey, Nick, we're going to have to get to it here. We're running down on time. So basically, you're asking Bruce if he has seen any kind of evidence or documentation about whether or not we've obtained technology, advanced technology, from somewhere else?
Yes, thank you, George. Thank you so
yeah,
much. Yes.
Thanks for the call. Bruce, anything along those lines?
Well, I don't buy the claims that back engineering the Roswell crash has resulted in a whole bunch of technological developments. I think the technological developments that are attributed to the Roswell crash would have happened anyway. And all of a lot of the other stuff that he's talking about is, in my opinion, highly questionable, like the flight of the Avenger aircraft probably crashed into the ocean. I forget all the other things he was talking about.
Separating wheat from chaff in this field is pretty tough. It's perilous.
That's right, and people who are coming into it fresh had better realize it's a minefield.
We've talked, I spoke earlier in the first hour about media role in all this. I mean, you make a point in the book a couple of times, we haven't touched on that, about how duplicitous the media can be. I mean, there was a Look magazine guy in the early days who, they refer to him in the Air Force documents, I think, as our friend, and he wrote an article that verified their trust. I mean, the role of the media is pretty sad in this thing.
Yeah, the media response, or the Look magazine response to the books by the articles by Donald
Kehoe,
saying that these things are interplanetary. The article, the guy went and interviewed a bunch of people at Air Technical Intelligence Center and read through cases and wrote an article in which he panned the whole subject, saying that it was essentially being worthy of consideration. There were a couple of magazine articles in the 1949-1950 time frame that panned the whole subject. Well, what was surprising was the Life magazine article in April of 1952, in which they said there was an argument in favor of interplanetary visitors.
Yeah, I mean, as you document in the book, behind the scenes, that really caused some ripples. The fact that an article could go contrary to what the crap that the Air Force was and CIA and others were dishing out. I mean, this. You can still make a difference. It gives me some kind of indication that it's all worthwhile to pursue it, because it can make a difference once in a while.
Yep.
And that's what you're trying to do.
That's what I'm trying to do.
What do you hope comes of the book?
What did you say?
What do you hope is the net effect of the book?
Well, of course, if it were to add to the weight swinging in the direction of... there's something really going on, that would be nice. I hope the book sells 10,000 copies or more.
Well, Bruce, thank you. Thanks for being here. We could go on for a long time, but this is some great work, and thank you for your decades of work on trying to uncover the truth.
And thank you for inviting me.
All right, best of luck with the book. We'll maybe have you back soon. The FBI CIA UFO Connection is the name of the book, Dr. Bruce Maccabee. I want to say also thanks to Billy Cox, my earlier guest, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staten, Tricia Pepe, and Dan Galante, and producer Chris Boros. Good night, everyone. I'll see you next month.